This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow, and the holiday season is upon us. Holiday dinners, office parties, lots of family, and the threat of salmonella from your turkey, and catching cold from your colleagues who love to double dip their chips, or getting the flu from that cup of cocoa that you shared with your niece. Here, try this. It's really good. Well, just how dangerous is all that spoon sharing and double dipping? Here to prove and disprove food myths are authors of the book, Did You Just Eat That? Two scientists explore double dipping, the five-second rule, and other food myths in the lab. Paul Dawson is a microbiologist and professor of food science at Clemson University. Hello, Paul.
Hello, thank you. Thanks for having me on.
Good to have you and your colleague Brian Sheldon, a professor emeritus in food microbiology at NC State. Hello, Brian.
Hello, Frank. Appreciate the opportunity to be here.
Good to have you. Brian, tell us about how this book came about.
Well, actually, it started some 10 years ago, and actually through Paul, Dr. Dawson, at Clemson University. They have what's called an inquiry program, basically to introduce undergraduates to conducting research, along with being mentored by other graduate students and faculty mentors. And Paul's particular area was in the food micro area, food safety in particular, and you know, just trying to get the interest up for the students. They thought, well, what could we examine, look at, and of course, the first thing that came to mind was this whole thing of the 5 second rule, and you know, can you drop a piece of food on the floor and pick it up within 5 seconds and still be safe to eat? And, of course, that caught the attention of these undergraduates. And out of that particular research project, a publication came out in a refereed scientific journal. And Paul can attest to this, that based upon the public media picking that up, he had interview after interview public interest in just that particular topic, and because that led to them conducting some additional studies, again, along the same route of food myths and the double dipping, for example. And again, a publication came out of that, and again, the same sort of public interest occurred. And Paul and I got talking about this, and additional research and other topics came about such that we thought, well, with the amount of public interest in these particular topics, we felt, well, maybe it's time for a book.
I guess so. Well, Paul, tell us more about that and actually how you go about this. Well, let's talk about double. Why don't we get into it right away? Double dipping. And let me ask you, first of all, about that, whether or not we really transfer much in the way of germs by taking a bite and putting it back in the dip.
Yeah, I think as you can tell by the title of the book, it's there's a serious side and a lighter side, and some of these topics, like double dipping, were starting out to be a light side, and obviously, the idea came from the Seinfeld episode. So you see, it's kind of already in the public interest, but we applied the scientific method to these kind of typical topics and almost kind of some obvious ones you'd think, and this is one that kind of surprised me because. Kind of thinking about when you bite a chip or dip or chip or cracker and dip it in a bowl of dip, there's not much surface area there. So we thought, well, I thought personally that there'd be some transfer, but it won't be very, very low or very, it would be hard to detect. But in actuality, when we did it, we found there was significant transfer of bacteria. And again, we did actually sterile water first because, again, we thought it'd be easy to recover. Then we moved to actual dips like salsa, chocolate dip, and cheese dip, and found over 1,000 bacteria were transferred versus virtually none recoverable when you just dip the chip in there without biting it. Then we found some interesting things as well with salsa. There was actually more transfer with salsa than there was chocolate or cheese. And while that wasn't initially obvious, it kind of was later because obviously salsa is much thinner. And we actually measured the viscosity of salsa compared to chocolate and cheese and documented that.
So the acid in the tomato didn't really help much.
Well, that's the other side of it. We actually tried to, all these studies, we tried to, into a real, quote, real world situation. We actually simulated if you had a party, we left the dip there 2 hours after the initial dipping and measured it 2 hours later. And actually the acid in the salsa did lower the number of bacteria there. But not to just
still not safe.
Still some there. So yeah, to answer, you know, the short answer to your question is, and actually these numbers I gave you are per milliliter of dip. So you can imagine at a party where you're dipping multiple times, much higher. So you are transferring oral bacteria to the dip.
And of course, there are multiple people doing this and lots of people who are taking part in taking it back out. But Brian, I guess that does raise a problem because scientific method, I mean, on the one hand, you like to use sterile water and these various media that are the same and controllable. But when you're talking about guacamole, you know, you've got different substances. So this, in some ways, proved to be a little different kind of experiment, did it not, or did it?
Well, I think, you know, as microbiologists who know something how organisms transfer, and Paul is correct in that we were not confused, but having seen the salsa results being, as it was, more microflora actually getting into the dip as opposed to the chocolate and cheese, it did throw us for a loop a little bit. But again, we generally try to control these experiments along with the, you know, for example, this was a real world scenario there. We do apply even proper controls to that as well. It's like, for example, when we just put the dip into the different sauces or dips, and you have relatively little or no transfer. So anytime that because we do want to run statistical analyses on the results, and if we don't have proper controls, we really don't have a good study that we can do a legitimate comparison.
So in
some respects, it is challenging because we have to determine what are the controls for each of the different experiments that we want to run.
So Paul, what kind of beer did you use for the beer pong, and how did that come out?
Yeah, that was actually a student's idea, as you can imagine.
Yeah.
And that's an interesting point because that's good. I'm glad you brought that up because we actually do, as Brian just described, some control studies where we have controls and also or inoculate, which we did with the beer pong. But we also do what we call kind of surveys, just go out in the public and gather data, which tends to give us a large variation. We were really concerned there about the average, but also the maximum and minimum. In this case, beer pong had two steps. One was we on a homecoming weekend down here in Clemson a few years ago, we sent the students out with clean ping pong balls to exchange for ping pong balls that were being used in real games. So we brought those back to the lab and enumerate the number of bacteria on them. And also kept track of where the game was being played, in other words, outdoors, tailgating, or indoors, or whatever, and just to get some differences, and actually found millions of bacteria on one ball, in particular one that was being played outdoors, but still very high levels on those ones. We took random samples. So that kind of demonstrated in that case, yes, there is bacteria on the balls that are being used in real games.
So I'm just going to describe this briefly, just in case you haven't seen. You set up a bunch of beer glasses, get yourself some of those red cups, fill them with beer or halfway or so. You make it, set them up like bowling pins. You drop a ping pong ball, and you try to get it into the glass. And if you do, the other guy has to drink the beer that the ball has fallen into. You go back and forth. You do this until both teams fall over. So, but here's the thing. So it doesn't really matter. I mean, honestly, can't matter because the ball has hit the ground 1,000 times. Your dog walks by 1,000 times. Who knows what other kinds of vermin had been skittering about in that room? Then the ball hits the ground. So it didn't really matter if it was a clean ball to start. It's pretty filthy by the time it hits your beer.
Well, it's that, and also you're right. The other probably more I would be more concerned with the person's hand.
Yeah.
Who's touching the ball?
Yeah,
and you described a scenario. We may kind of make a one in the book, kind of funny one. I think, or maybe not be that funny. But someone's playing beer pong, and they obviously more beer you drink. Eventually, you've got to go to the laboratory, and you've had a lot of beer. Kind of hand hygiene might be not the first priority. Getting back to the game, so this person goes back to the game, picks the ball up, and then throws it in your beer, and you drink that. We've had some discussions in recent interviews where, we've seen people have a little glass of water there. You put the ball in, supposedly to clean it off, but then there's a couple things going on there. Yeah, the ball's now wet, and you put it back in your hand. The water you're putting it in is actually getting inoculated as well. So,
right.
And I'm not sure there's a foolproof solution to that.
And, well, now, wait a minute. Here's one, though, and you do address this in the book. I'm sure a lot of those students are thinking, oh, it's fine. I know the hands are dirty, the floor is dirty, but alcohol is the great sterilizer. We're going to be fine.
Yeah, well, I can go on. We cite some other research in the book, and one was in another chapter related to a study done by someone trying to determine the best drink, alcohol or drink to have in a developing country so you don't get Montezuma's revenge. So they went through the long list of starting with carbonated beverages and then beer and wine and kind of up the scale of alcohol level, and really there was none that really alcoholic drink that really was safe. And there was one, tequila, ended up being one that actually did lower the levels, but it took, you know, a certain amount of time because it's a time exposure problem there. So really, certainly beer has virtually no effect on reducing bacteria.
No, but now you have just suggested tequila pong, which is 6 ounces of tequila every time the ball falls in. And the only good thing about that is you will just consume far less before you hit the floor. Brian, let's talk about restaurants, which, you know, we all worry a little bit about contamination, but you and your book have generated a brand new concern that I never considered before reading your book, and that is the menu.
Well, yeah, the menu is one of those things that if you've eaten in any restaurants, you've always, well, at least I've asked the question, I wonder, when was the last time this was washed or sanitized? And it's something that all the customers handle, the waiters and waitresses handle, and you just, you know, the question is, how often is it sanitized? And, you know, some of these menus look like they need to be replaced, you know, several years ago.
As you excavate the chili to see what's the price was under the plastic, you know, I hear what you mean.
And like Paul said initially, we like to start these studies out by doing a little bit of a survey. And in this particular case, a number of different restaurants of different types of restaurants, ranging from Mexican restaurants to, you know, steakhouses, pizza places, beer joints, et cetera, that serve food. Their menus were sampled and determined what the populations were. And as you can imagine, there was a significant population. And we were just, you know, taking samples by simply swabbing about a 6-inch area of the menu. It didn't include the entire menu. But based upon the results, there were significant populations, and of course some of the high ones. And again, because of the limited number of restaurants that were sampled, we don't want to come out and make any overall conclusions that say a Mexican restaurant versus a upscale restaurant is any better or worse than the other. But we did find in this particular case that one of the Mexican restaurants that were sampled had the highest concentration of bacteria, microorganisms, and it was followed by an upscale restaurant too. In addition, we looked at busy times of the day versus slow times, busy being that of the noon as well as dinner hours, and saw that in general that the busier, the more customers that were coming in and to the restaurant, the higher the populations.
Yeah. And see, you scrupulously wash your hands before you eat, and then you pick up the menu, and all is for naught.
Yeah.
Well, let's get to, I want to talk more about restrooms, too, in a second, but we do have to get to what we used to call it the 10-second rule. We were much more tolerant than apparently the informants for your book, the 5-second rule. But, you know, drop something on the floor, count to 10, and eat it. Now, I have to say, when we did this, nobody really believed that you hadn't contaminated your food. It was just so you'd have some kind of a rule to give you cover for eating the Tootsie Roll that you just dropped and rolled in the dog hair. I don't care. I'm eating my Tootsie Roll. But now you've done the study. The 5-second rule. Paul, let me ask you, what'd you find? Is it true? Just 5 seconds? Not that bad?
You were right the first time. Yeah. Yeah, and like you said, a lot of these studies, and again, I made before the title of the book kind of gives lead into that, but this was a study that we pretty much knew that it would be transferable. We want to put some numbers to it and really test some variables. So we looked at 5 seconds in contact, 30 seconds in contact, and 60 seconds in contact with the contaminated surface. So, and we also inoculated, went and got from a home supply store carpet, tile, and wood, and inoculated with salmonella. Typhimurium, and then actually left the bacteria on that surface a little while before we dropped it, tested different times. So we had some different variables going there. But the take-home message was that you can't pick it up quick enough. If it's there, it's going to be on the food.
These little microbes are smart. They've been here for a long time, and if they were a little bit lazy about jumping on the next bus to your gut, they would not be here, right? I mean, the fact is they're there right away.
Right, and they're smarter than I think most people think they are. They actually form very almost immediately, start trying to form biofilms, it's called, and they actually communicate with each other with something that's called quorum sensing, where they send chemicals and pretty elaborate, what I would describe as, if you look under a microscope magnification enough, look almost like a coral reef. And once those biofilms form, they are very difficult to get rid of. And also they will survive better and still release cells. And I think Brian did this example, I remember years ago, I think everybody can identify with a common biofilm is when you wake up in the morning, your teeth, and you rub your tongue across your teeth, that's a biofilm, and you really can't get that off without brushing. You can rinse and it won't get off. So they are very very smart and adaptable.
We are talking about what you should and should not eat, myths about food contamination, with my guest Paul Dawson and Brian Sheldon, author of the book, Did You Just Eat That? Conversation happening right here on The State of Things. Well, Paul, let me stick with you for just one second about this business, and maybe this goes outside, I think, the scope of the book, but you talked about just how smart these microorganisms are, the fact that they communicate, quorum sensing. This is fascinating stuff, because if you think about pathogens getting in your body, you've got an immune system, and if just a few of them jump in, you've got white cells that are ready to attack and should annihilate them. But for some reason, they don't notice them until they reach critical mass. And this gets back to, I think, you can tell me if I'm wrong, this quorum sensing. They don't act pathogenic. They don't start acting up until there are enough of them to have a fair chance against your immune system. Am I right about this?
I think in some cases, we use, you know, salmonella is in the news a lot. Usually it takes a large dose of salmonella to make a healthy person sick. And so there's a critical population and there's different ways that bacteria make us sick. And one is, using salmonella as a typical example, is an infection. It's a live cell we ingest, and they attach in our intestinal tract or in our digestive tract and start replicating and really create a osmosis, if you will. We can't control the water flow. But then something like Clostridium botulinum or Staphylococcus aureus produces a toxin outside the body. And so once that toxin's produced, it's almost impossible to eliminate or destroy. And so then the cell, the bacteria can be long dead, and we just eat the food, and the toxin itself will make us sick.
Which is why just cooking spoiled food won't make it all go away, right? In some cases.
Yeah, in most cases, yeah. In some cases. I mean, Clostridium botulinum is unique to most pathogens because it requires no oxygen to grow. That's why your canned food, don't eat a canned food if it's swollen or damaged, and vacuum packaged food, if it's not going to be, like I say, heating it afterwards is not going to destroy toxins. So there's a lot of concern with those. There's all kinds of different ways can make us sick.
Well, Brian, just one last question. I mean, the fact is we can measure these, and it's great that you actually did the science and you know, disabused us of whatever it was that we or the myths that we were holding. But the fact is we do eat a lot of this, and the body's quite happy, quite able, capable of managing bacteria. You can't live without it. We're always bringing it in. So just knowing these things doesn't mean we should. For God's sake, we shouldn't just stop playing beer pong, right?
No, there's not a surface that you can touch that doesn't have microorganisms on it. They're very adaptable to about every environment on this earth. You know, from the highest temperature geysers to the lowest temperatures. You know, in the North Pole. They're going to be there. In fact, there's more bacteria in our gut and on our skin than there are human cells in our bodies.
There you go. Like 30, so we need it. We've adapted. And that's good stuff. I wish I had more time. I am out now. But the good news is, as you were about to say, there's so much of us that's that we shouldn't be terrified. But now that we're aware, we're deeply appreciative. Brian Sheldon, Professor Emeritus in Food Microbiology at NC State. Paul Dawson, Microbiologist and Professor of Food Science at Clemson. Authors of the book, Did You Just Eat That? Thank you both for being on the program.
Thank you, Frank.
Thank you. Thanks, Frank.
And you can find out more at our website, stateofthings.org. Coming up, the music of the Chompy Quartet. Stay with us.